You're listening to a Comics XF podcast. Welcome to the 300th episode of the Comics XF Interview Podcast, the show where two best friends talk about comics with the people who make them. I'm Dan Grote.
And I'm Matt Lazowitz.
And this week's guest is the writer of Marvel's upcoming Blood Hunt event. And starting this summer, we'll be writing a little indie title called X-Men, plus, you know, the Avengers, Doctor Strange, a bunch of other stuff. Jed McKay. Jed, thank you for joining us on this auspicious occasion.
Oh, thank you for having me. 300 is quite the number.
It is big and round, absolutely. So this weekend on Twitter, in a friendly game of my X-Men can beat up your X-Men with Gail Simone, you dropped a bomb in the form of a very good skeleton boy covered in pink bioparaffin, which of course made a number of X-Men fans incredibly happy. What is it like to wield that kind of power?
And a number incredibly salty.
That's true, equal measure.
I mean, it's fun, you know. There's a lot of people who are, you know, very excited, very apprehensive, and kind of everything between those two on the spectrum about what's happening with X-Men. And I'm just looking forward to the books getting out there, so people can kind of see for themselves, read a book and decide whether or not the sky has fallen, as opposed to just spinning up into frenzies of speculation.
Of course. Well, before we get into the X-Men of it all, first, before any of that happens, you've got Blood Hunt, which is your big summer vampire event launching May 1st. Matt, ice skate uphill for us, please.
The skies have gone dark, the sun hiding its face from the carnage to come. The children of the night, the vampires, have risen from the dark and hidden places of the world as one to drown the Marvel Universe in blood. Earth's final night has fallen. Can even the heroes of this doomed world stem the tide of blood that is to come?
Now, Matt, I have to say, before we continue, at some point in like the late 100s, you doing dramatic readings of the Diamond Solicit blurb became a thing. That may have been your most dramatic reading yet. And I applaud you, sir.
Yeah, I figured I'd pull out all the stops for episode 300.
Fair.
That was also written in a way that really lent itself to me just punching all the right words. So, Jed, how long has this event been in the works? It feels like there's been a slow build of vampires consolidating power between some of the stuff in Avengers earlier on, pre your run, Wolverine, Blade, and your Moon Knight.
I've been working on it formally since a little over a year ago. Would have been, I think, March, February, something like that. Tommy emailed me and said, listen, we've got a lot of vampire stuff going on. I want to do an event and it is about vampires. And that was kind of, the brief. So, we talked back and forth about a few things. I laid a certain amount of work in Moon Knight already that could then pay off in Blood Hunt, or what would later kind of be known as Blood Hunt for quite some time is known as UVE, which was an untitled vampire event. Because we went back and forth on a lot of titles for the series, and at one point I was like, well, I've got these bad guys, I'm going to call them the Blood Hunt. And Tom was like, yeah, marketing took that name, so you got to think of a new name for your bad guys. I was like, well, at least the event has a name now. But yeah, it's been cooking for a while, both kind of formally and then just the the pieces of it that get brought together with we saw the introduction of the Bloodline, the daughter of Blade. In recent years, all the Dracula Vampire Nation stuff, the structure in Moon Knight. This is kind of where we see it all come together in a big way.
How much extra math is involved in writing, you know, the big summer crossover? Like, how involved are you, if anything, with like tie-ins and stuff like that?
It's not too bad, that side of it. Like, this is the most stressful thing I've ever done, comic book wise, or, you know, certainly writing comics, because it's not just doing a big event that has a huge footprint that kind of like touches on most of the books that are coming out. It's also, you know, we've got a 5-issue main series in Blood Hunt. It also ties in directly with the books I'm writing. Excuse me, specifically Moon Knight, or at the time now, Vengeance of Moon Knight, Doctor Strange, and Avengers. Because, you know, it's easier for me to put my own characters through the ringer than everybody else's. Though, when that's the Avengers, that is also everybody else's character. So that's kind of it's been a difficulty, I think, that I've had to impose on other people, which is something new. Yeah, so figuring, you know, all the important stuff in the story has to happen in this miniseries, but there also has to be stuff to happen in the books of these characters who are involved in the miniseries. So there's a lot of kind of juggling, and it's not something I'd ever done before. So there's a few nervous breakdowns, so I was kind of putting it all together. But as far as tie-ins and stuff go, that's not really, outside of the ones I'm writing, obviously, that's not really my my wheelhouse. You know, the editors are coordinating all that. I've talked to other writers just to kind of say, okay, well, if they have questions, or like, you know, who are these characters, what's happening in this issue, in this month, where is this character, that kind of thing. But outside of that, everyone's pretty much got a free hand to explore the night.
And again, you are, you know, writing a few books at during this time, and obviously they're your series and you control the pacing, but were there any books where you felt like you had to move a little faster to wrap up arcs in time for everything to come together for Blood Hunt month?
Not really. Strange and Avengers are both finished 2-issue arcs, ending off with the lead into Blood Hunt. You know, the 2-issue arc is something I'm fairly comfortable with. I used to do a lot in Black Cat. Vengeance kind of always was planned to lead into Blood Hunt next month, which we'll see. And, you know, it brings Hunter's Moon and Tigra into the action in a very direct way. And then that will continue the story that, you know, some story stuff we have been setting up in Vengeance will play out through Blood Hunt. And then in Vengeance, it will also be explored further. A lot of kind of back and forth on that one. You know, there's like, you know, a bit of overlap on story beats here and there, and, you know, more like expanding stuff that doesn't get fully explored in the main series. So it's been tricky, but I think it's coming out pretty well. The planning was the hard part. The writing, surprisingly, was the easiest part of the whole process. Because at that point, I kind of, you know, I had to figure out what was going to happen and how it was going to happen in each issue. Once that was figured out, all that was left was, you know, go from point A to point B to C, et cetera.
Now, looking at sort of the leads of this story, or the leads of the books that you're writing in this story, if I'm Doctor Strange and I'm seeing all these vampires all of a sudden, at what point am I asking, did I take care of these guys in the 80s?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. The Montesi formula is the word on everybody's lips here in issue one. We've got at least two entities in the world who would have access to the Montesi formula, you know, Doctor Strange having cast it before, and Wanda Maximoff, who is, you know, the living Darkhold, the Darkhold containing the Montesi formula. So I think it's safe to say that both Wanda and Strange will be high priority targets in the coming event for our forces of the night here.
Now, at what point in the conversations did the Red Band comics come up?
That came up pretty early. I was pitching my first draft of it, or maybe my second draft, on would have been the Marvel Spring Summit about a year ago. And it was on Zoom, so, you know, everyone's just chatting away. And I'm pretty sure that was a Jerry Duggan idea. He brought it up. People, you know, the the higher ups seemed to really like it. That was a fun kind of marketing angle, something a little different. And, you know, it being, I believe, exclusively available at shops. Like, I don't think there's digital versions of the Red Band. So, you know, it gets people back in stores, which is always kind of what we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was interesting. I wasn't sure how it was going to work. I'd never done anything like that before. And really, that was something that, you know, that Pepe really took the baton on, because he's, you know, he said, where can we identify areas that we can, you know, punch things up a bit? We can expand things a bit. So we have, you know, alternate pages of art. And in other cases, we have actual new pages and expanded sequences. And, you know, so, okay, we could probably, you know, zazz this fight up a bit, and then Pepe would just put in a whole nother page of just, you know, his incredible Pepe stuff, and, you know, gave it real gruesome and gnarly. And yeah, I think he had a really good time with it. So we'll see what the readers think. You know, I hope they like it. It's a gimmick, but it's a horror comic. You know, that's where you pull the gimmicks out for.
Favorite Marvel vampire story that is neither your own nor Wolfman and Colin Tomb of Dracula?
That's a tough one. Kind of put me on the spot there. Especially because Tomb of Dracula is always the go-to, because, you know, Tomb of Dracula is just sick as hell.
Oh. All right. I'm gonna jump in here while Jed thinks, actually. I have my answer. And it is Captain Britain and MI-13 Vampire State.
Of course you do.
Yeah, you know what? That's a good one. You know, shooting vampires from orbit. That was great stuff. You know, Dracula on the moon meeting Dr. Doom. Oh man, I loved Captain Britain the MI-13. That was great. That was a great book.
My pet mutant is Pete Wisdom. And so when people tell me that they don't like the character, I remind them that he stopped a vampire invasion from the moon because they hadn't been invited.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, man, your favorite unit is Pete Wisdom. That's a tough go.
I know.
I think that's got to be up there. I was reading a bunch of old Blade issues from, like, I think the 90s. I had a great kind of almost like hand-painted logo that I haven't seen since. It's just kind of like real gonzo stuff that I have a lot of fun with, you know, like vampire clones. I know that's where Bloodstorm 1 from the Blood Coven came from. And, you know, like sunlight guns. It's real kind of like weird gonzo 90s stuff that I feel like has largely been forgotten, that I never see anyone talk about, but it was also, I believe, you know, pre-movie Blade. So they're still kind of figuring out what Blade was before, you know, Wesley Snipes came in and everyone's like, oh, that's it. You know, we got it. We got zeroed in. That's going to be Blade from here on out.
So they brought out, we invoked his name once already, but they brought out the big guns for this. You're working with Pepe Larraz on art. You've worked with plenty of great artists in your day, of course, but how has working with Pepe been on this?
It's been great. I mean, when, you know, I didn't know, like, that was a little later on that I found out Pepe was going to be drawing it. And it was a very, I'm not going to say frightening, but certainly daunting proposition. Because, you know, Pepe he's one of the top superhero comic artists in the world. Like, he's at the top of his game. And he's going to be writing, you know, the book that he's going to be drawing the book that I wrote. And, you know, my thoughts is like, is he going to like this? Is he going to think it sucks? Is he going to think this is beneath him? And, you know, I got a real, real kind of sense of existential doubt. But, you know, we've worked together great. You know, he's incredible. We got this started with a pretty significant amount of time for him to work on the book and, like, really give it his all. And it looks incredible. Like, I did the lettering for number 4. And it's just something else. Like, no one can do scale like he can. You know, these big kind of city vistas and strange things. I mean, he's a wizard. He's got a gift that very few have, and I'm very excited for people to see it. It's also kind of comforting because if it is a bad story, kind of doesn't matter.
Because it's going to look pretty as hell.
Yeah, I mean, even like the first issue, we see his take on the impossible city where the Avengers live, and it just looks so cool. And like, it's rare you see someone doing just background that you look at and you're like, wow, that's so well designed and so cool.
With that, I not on a spoiler hunt, but I'm curious, the number of books that you have going into this crossover, is that the same number as the number of books that you have coming out of it?
Yes. We're going to, I mean, there's not really much I can say about stuff like that.
Fair.
Just it's kind of like the nature of the beast. I'm looking at a pretty heavy workload, especially while I was still writing Blood Hunt, which is a real pain in the ass because I thought I was like, because I took on X-Men. I was like, well, I'm sure I don't need to start writing that till I finish writing Blood Hunt. And then I think it was like November, Tom emailed me. He's like, yeah, I'm gonna need that first script in like 2 weeks. And I had gotten COVID for the first time at New York Comic Con. So I was like sitting in my basement in a bed. And I'm like, oh no, now I gotta figure out what the hell this comic's gonna look like. And everybody else is like, oh no, I'm writing five comics at once. But yeah, it's thankfully, Blood Hunt is, of course, a limited series. I finished that a month or two ago. So it's a much easier thing to deal with. That said, I also forgot that X-Men is 18 a year. So that's kind of like having one and a half books. So.
Well, let's pivot to talking about X-Men a little bit.
Sure.
Where are you? What are you doing when you get the call that you're going to be writing X-Men?
I mean, I'm a comic book writer. I was just sitting in that chair over there, like I do for most of the day, pretty much every day.
Looks comfortable.
I mean, it's not bad. But yeah, that's, Tom emailed me. We talked briefly, because the rumors were going around that he was leaving Avengers. I was like, bullshit, Tom's not leaving Avengers. So I emailed him. I'm like, what are you doing? Like, are you going to studios? Are you gonna work on video games? He's like, no, I'm leaving Avengers. Six. Didn't expect that. He's like, and then I'm taking over X-Men. I was like, oh wow, that's pretty exciting. And then a month or a few weeks later, I don't remember how long it was. He's like, well, I want you to see what ideas you have for an X-Men book. He's Tom being Tom. He's got a big document written out of all his thoughts. And he said, I've got three X-Men series that we want to launch with. And I'd like you to take a look and see if any of these, if you've got anything for any of these. Anyway, he laid out what would become Uncanny, he laid out what would become X-Men, and laid out what would become Exceptional X-Men. And I was like, well, Uncanny looks great. Mutants out there, showing the world that mutants are helping people, that kind of thing. Which I think they have pivoted a bit from that now because Gale brought in all the new mutants. I was like, well, it's the original iteration of that concept. I was like, well, it's a little close to what we got in Avengers. But X-Men, I said I wanted to have Cyclops and had this vision of Magneto in the chair. And I don't remember if Beast was in his thing or if I came up with that. But I was like, well, I really like Cyclops. I think he's a cool, really cool character. And I think could do something, take a different angle on a team book. And yeah, after a few iterations of what I wanted to do with that, where I wanted to go with it, said, yeah, we're good to go. Let's get this going. And also a big part of it was when I brought Ryan on board because, I had a pitch, I had a team, and then Tom's like, well, we're talking to Ryan, want him on a book. We think he'd be a good match for X-Men. I'm like, yeah, that's great. I mean, Ryan's an amazing artist, and I'd love to, do a good run with him. But he came in with concerns about the books, saying, well, you're this team you've got now, they all have pretty much the same silhouette. They all have pretty much the same way of moving. And so on the page, that's not going to be particularly interesting. And I was like, I didn't think about that because I'm not an artist. So we made some changes with some characters that add a little more visual flair. That's where Juggernaut came in, because obviously the Juggernaut presents a different silhouette than your average shaped mutant. and a few other things. And yeah, it's just been coming together great. You know, Ryan's chugging away at number two, and I'm looking forward to that first issue coming up.
So I feel like we've already kind of started to answer this question, but you know, generally when it comes to assembling a superhero team, you want to have that balance of powers as opposed to, you know, oops, all psychics or oops, all Wolverines or whatever. Is there a way?
Unless that's the concept of the book.
Yeah, that fair. There has been a book called Wolverines, plural. But what is a way that doing that with the X-Men is different from doing that with the Avengers?
Well, I think there's a certain amount of freedom doing it with the X-Men, given that kind of the concept behind Avengers when I took it on was I wanted to put all the big name characters on the team, you know, treat it like Marvel's pantheon. You can't really do that with the X-Men, especially if you're doing three different teams. So, you know, the original five are kind of like carved up between different books, as well as, you know, I think the 90s iteration being one of the more popular X-Men versions, those characters kind of got chopped up between teams. So for me, I wanted to strike a balance of characters that have a narrative heft, have legacy is not exactly the right word, but you know, they have a pedigree that people respect and are interested in, and ultimately, you know, that people will buy, because there are characters that are popular and people will buy the books that they're in. Mixed with characters I think that could use a push, could use a little shine. And then on top of that, you know, characters that I like, characters that I think would have interesting interactions with one another. You know, creating those interpersonal triangles between characters where on the surface they all have a fairly similar motivation, but it gets more complicated the more time they spend around each other. And now they're, you know, in a converted Sentinel factory in Alaska with nothing to do but bounce off one another when they're not on, you know, doing their missions or getting up to tasks. So on top of that, there's a bit of a division where, you know, we've got our field team of X-Men who go out and do stuff, which are the ones on the cover, you know, Cyclops, Psylocke, Temper, Kid Omega, Juggernaut, and Magic. But we've also got more, you know, at the base, on the base team, you know, Beast is the base director. We have Magneto as sort of a spiritual leader of the team. And then there's a few actors, you know, Glob Herman is there, just kind of, you know, vibing. You know, we haven't announced it there, but, you know, Zorn is there as well. He's, you know, the team's, you know, medical professional. He's, you know, he's a healer. And then anytime we do want to have more mutants there, they can be hanging out at the base, because, you know, it's a big factory complex. They have plenty of space, and there's, you know, overarching goals that will be better served by the mutants turning up.
So I don't think that I did this consciously in prepping for tonight, but I would like to point out on camera that I am actually wearing my Glob Herman t-shirt from artist Marcelo Biot. So shout out to him. But, you know, one thing, you know, obviously in doing this, as we mentioned, it part of it is figuring out where to put sort of the marquee characters. But another thing is, you know, at this point, there are so many generations of younger mutants, and everyone has their faves and are very passionate about them to varying degrees of constructiveness.
Sure.
Yeah. How do you go about, or, you know, you and whatever parties are involved, kind of picking which ones to use, which kind of eras of younger mutants to highlight, that kind of thing?
Yeah, like that's largely represented in X-Men by, of course, you know, Quentin and Idy. Mm-hmm. I wasn't, you know, that was something that I was like, well, you know, you want to kind of help build these characters so that they can be, you know, have the opportunity, or hopefully, to become marquee characters in the future. But at the same time, I also knew that, you know, NYX was coming, which is the book that is focused on young mutants, and yeah, I think it's I've been reading a bunch of the scripts as they come in, and it's, you know, it's a very cool book. They've got a really great cast that is rotating in a really interesting way. So I wasn't super concerned, but at the same time, you know, you don't want it all just to be the marquee characters, because you have that opportunity to bring in characters and give them some shine. So, and also, it's just, what characters do I like? Who do I think would be fun to write? What power set would be neat for cool stuff? That kind of thing. And of course, and, you know, you want to have an eye towards some amount of diversity as well on the team, because if you look at any, you know, if you look at the original X-Men, they all kind of look the same there. And then that, you know, that big push with the, you know, the giant size X-Men team, where it's all characters from around the world. It was such a cool way to approach X-Men. So yeah, it's a lot of it just kind of comes from balancing these popular characters that you know you can use to sell a book, because ultimately that's what we're doing, is we need to sell books, with the less popular characters that you think can drift on that popularity in order to build their own popularity.
So as someone who's writing both the X-Men and the Avengers right now, what do you see as kind of the relationship status between those teams at this point? Because it's had its ups and downs.
Yeah, it certainly has. At this point in time, you know, I've got the X-Men appearing in, I just, you know, wrote Avengers number 18. The X-Men appear briefly in there. At the moment, I've got all these my X-Men and the Avengers on relatively good terms. We're going to see kind of why as the future goes on, you know, but, you know, in the future, who can say? I think I'm very hesitant to have the X-Men and the Avengers come into conflict without, it would have to be an extremely good reason, because I'm very sick of the Avengers always being the man, you know, coming to step on everyone's good time, or like, you know, oh, these misunderstood heroes, the Avengers are going to keep them in line. So I'd like to avoid that and see what it looks like, you know, moving in a different direction. That said, if an idea strikes me, I'm like, oh, that's a great idea. I'm like, no, that's all right. They're going to get into a fight over a softball game or something, you know?
Well, softball game, you know, that's a classic. But no, that certainly fits in line with, you know, Carol's whole thing has been since issue one is, you know, yeah, we're not cops.
So yeah, and that was a very conscious reason for that, because again, like when I got the Avengers, I'm like, well, I'm so sick of them being the you know, the fuddy-duddies, the you know, being the man and the, you know, the authority. Well, not the authority, but you know, I mean,
that's a different superhero deconstruction.
that's a whole other situation. So yeah, we'll explore what that looks like going on. Having both an X-Men team and the Avengers is going to be a really interesting thing moving forward. And I'd like to build connectivity between those two series, because it just makes sense.
Certainly. On the topic of the Avengers and also the artists that you've worked it with, the most recent arc where the Avengers are taking out Orcus, the sort of big bad Orcus representative is MODOK. Now, Francesco Mortarino, who is going to be drawing, I believe it's NYX coming up. Correct me if I'm wrong. Oh, thank you. Draws MODOK with a gorgeous head of chestnut hair.
Yeah. Francesco, he did such good work on those issues, like, because I've worked with him before, but I think these two issues he did for us before moving over to NYX were just like really great stuff. I love his 3D, man. I think he's so expressive, and because, you know, the whole issue, whenever you see the bad guys, you know, MODOK and 3D man, they're always just in like a base, they're in an office, mm-hmm. like they're not doing anything exciting except yelling at each other. But he manages to inject those scenes with such energy that it's some of my favorite stuff to look at, you know, outside, you know, and that's an issue where they're like constantly trashing robots and blowing up buildings, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So writing for books out of the Hero's Office, as you have, you already had, and we've talked about this, you know, you already had a working relationship with Tom Brefort. Mm-hmm. What is the best or most memorable note that he's given you in your time working together?
The thing is, I started working with Tom Brevoort on Avengers Next Strike, which was a few years ago. And because up till then, I was basically working almost only with Nick Lowe. Nick gave my first jobs at Marvel. He edited Black Cat, which was my first ongoing. And Nick is very effusive. So you send him a script, comes back, it's like, this was amazing. Sticks exclamation points. This was incredible. This is possibly the best issue that's ever come out. And so, you know, he's very, very high level, very, ebullient in his praise. So when I started working for Tom, I wasn't prepared for that to be like the complete opposite. So I'd send him, you know, a Max Strike script, and I get it back. He's like, this is very readable. And I'd be like, you know, crushed. Until I realized, like, no, that's just the way it is. Like, it's fine. That's a perfectly good response to a good script. You know, like, this, like, we can publish this. So the one that always stands out to me is that I was asked to pitch for Avengers, and it was a very stressful time for me because I was like, well, I don't think I'm going to be able to do this, or you know, I'm up against other writers who I think are better than I am. So by the time I sent in that first script, it was a real kind of a lot of various crises of faith on my part. And I was in the hardware store buying light fixtures, and I checked my phone. I got an email from Tom, and I was like, okay, shit, Tom's reading the Avengers script. I'm gonna probably gonna be torn apart. And the first line was, it swings, exclamation point. And I just about fell over, because I've never received such praise from Tom in my career. And I've written a lot of books for him at that point in time, you know, a lot of issues. So that's the one that always sticks to me. The rare compliment.
Compliment, like that. So pivoting to a different book now, Marvel is collecting your Moon Knight run in an omnibus for release later this year. Do you have a spot mapped out for it on your bookcase or in a high traffic spot in your home?
What's probably going to happen is that I'm going to read it, and I'm going to be very, very pleased with it. And I'll take it and lend it to my dad, like I did my Black Cat omnibus. And he kind of like puts it in a place of pride at their place, because he likes, you know, likes to see it, see the design. Because I mean, I'm not a big omnibus collector, just because I'm cheap. So I'll buy individual trades, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So when I got it, they sent me the King and Black omnibus, because I did what, 4 issues in that. I think it was like 3 Black Cat issues and a Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. And that thing, like, you could stop a car with it. It's so big. And yeah, you know, so I got the Black Cat one, and I was like, well, thankfully it's significantly smaller, because then I can actually read it. So it does present difficulties in reading sometimes. Of course, it doesn't stop me. You know, I've got all the Battle Angel Alita Last Order omnibus, which are like, you know, trade paperbacks this thick, where mm-hmm. I'm trying to read them, I can hear the spine cracking because they're so like structurally unsound.
So I own one like super thickened bad boy omnibus, and it's the Jack Kirby Fourth World omnibus. Ooh, and yeah. I still have it in the shrink wrap, just because like I'm afraid to like crack the spine or anything. But at the same time, I have made the blasphemous move of using it to hold up my computer, my second computer monitor.
Wow.
Because this is the thickest book I own.
what a study of contrasts. I value this too much to read it, but I will use it as furniture.
But it does have a practical use.
There you go. I mean, you know, it's making its cost back.
Yes.
You can write it off as an office expense.
Yeah, there you go.
I tried. My accountant said no.
So, somewhat similar to the question I asked about Blood Hunt earlier,
sure.
How long into your run on Moon Knight did you know you were going to kill off Mark Spector?
I remember talking about it to Alessandro Capuccio the first time I met him at New York Comic Con. Not the one that passed this fall, but previous to that. So it'd be 2022. Because I was sitting there like, listen, I'm gonna try to convince Tom to let us kill Moon Knight, and then we're gonna have all the Midnight Mission crew together on the last page doing like a welcome to Midnight Mission. I can help you. And like an eight ball is gonna be there, and he's gonna be in a suit. It's gonna be awesome. Alessandro was like, sure, sounds good. So I had been meaning to kill Moon Knight for a while, and then I was like, well, I don't know if this is gonna work because like the timing with Blood Hunt, because Blood Hunt first iteration Moon Knight was not dead for it, so he was directly involved. Like they had like vampire suicide bombers coming into the Midnight Mission or something like that. But then I figured a way to make it work and work in a way that leads right into Blood Hunt. So once I got that those kind of ducks in a row, then it's like, okay, well, it's we're committed to this course now, and let's see how it works. It also helps too because as we were approaching the end of that Black Spectre story, Tom was like, well, we want to this book has been doing great. It's gone to 30 issues at that point in time. But also this being what it is, do you have any ideas to kind of punch things up a bit, shake things up so we can, keep people interested and keep people going? I'm like, well, yeah, why don't we just kill Moon Knight? And it's like, all right, fair enough. And I was like, and then, we can relaunch with the new number one if you want. I'd prefer not to because I like seeing the issue numbers go up as like a personal triumph. But, Marvel's never seen an excuse for a new number one they haven't liked. So, anyway, he's like, well, it's like, that's great. We can relaunch that. We'll have this mystery of who the new Moon Knight is. I will have, we'll dust off the Vengeance of the Moon Knight title for something a little different. And that's just kind of where we committed to that.
So you mentioned the Midnight Mission crew, and Moon Knight had a supporting cast historically. And while they've popped up or been mentioned, you've mostly built out new characters like Reese and Soldier and Hunter's Moon. And each of them seem to be some aspect of Mark, the Priest of Khonshu, the Soldier, the defender of the innocent and the downtrodden. How, which I have to imagine was very much an intentional choice with each of those characters.
It actually was. It just kind of shook out that way.
Oh, well, then that the question about how building characters who are set up to do that, but also has to be full characters on their own, doesn't really matter anymore.
Yeah, that just kind of happened. Because they all kind of started out in different ways, where Reese is kind of there from my initial pitch because at the beginning I was like, well, how do we start this out? Well, Moon Knight's got to be fighting someone, and might as well be vampires. And I was like, well, what if he needs to save one? And then that's where Reese came from. Soldier was actually a character that I had kicking around, not fully in that iteration, but this idea that he used to be a Hydra guy and then goes back to his old neighborhood. But I had kicking around for something. It was more of like a Punisher kind of story than anything. And then we kind of repurposed him for Moon Knight. And then Hunter's Moon, the original conceit there was to actually have a whole host of Fists of Khonshu from around the world, kind of a like a Batman of all nations sort of thing. And then Tom very wisely put the kibosh on it. He's like, listen, if you tell me there's like 15 more Fists of Khonshu out there, that's not interesting. You're just kind of diluting the brand. But if you tell me that there's one other, that's a lot more interesting. I was like, oh shit, yeah, left and right fists, right? That makes sense. An old New Testament. And that's where Hunter's Moon came from. Though it was a real bastion of a time trying to come up with a name for him because it takes between 6 and 10 issues of a new character appearing before their name seems like a good name. Prior to that, it's just kind of like, this is an awkward name.
And being that this is going to be dropping mid to late April, it's a bit early to talk about the end of issue 4 too much, but I didn't see that coming, possibly due to the fact that I'm not a big Avengers West Coast person, but it seems like the clues were there if you were familiar with Moon Knight's history there.
Yeah, a not insignificant amount of people guessed it, in part because of the clues that were there, in part because of the Blood Hunt ashcan or preview, whatever it was, showed some stuff that will be happening a little later on down the line in Vengeance. So, you know, people were guessing it because, you know, using Dark Force, having, I wouldn't say a relationship, but certainly an acquaintanceship with Moon Knight in the past, you know, between West Coast Avengers and, you know, they had a story together in the Marvel Infinity Comics it was an Avengers one. They're fighting, you know, Mr. Pandemonium and lore and stuff like that. So yeah, it seemed like a good candidate for that. Yeah, you got those exciting Dark Force powers, which are something new to bring in. He's not the most stable individual if you've been following through, if you were following him in Daredevil. So yeah, it seemed like, and you know, I think he's a cool character. And then Alessandro turned out that like absolutely killer Black Moon Knight costume. So my instinct was like, oh, we'll just put him in the old white Moon Knight costume. That'll be like the contrast. Tom's like, no. We need a cool new costume. I'm like, yeah, you know what? Fair enough.
The new moon.
Yeah, there you go.
So, I mean, granted, you haven't gotten or probably won't get much of an opportunity to write one of these, but which location would an invading force have a harder time with? Krakoa or the Midnight Mission?
Probably Krakoa, because it's much bigger. Well, actually, no. Krakoa's not doing that great these days. the thing is, I don't think they would. If we're talking about the vampires, I don't think they really care about Krakoa, because no one lives there. What are they going to do? Like, bite a tree? Whereas the mission, you know, we're going to see in Vengeance, I think Vengeance 7? No, Vengeance 6. We're going to see what the Midnight Mission crew is doing, you know, during the Blood Hunt. And it's a lot of fun. We've got Reese, we've got Soldier, we've got Apollo out there. You know, just out there trying to save lives.
So you and Alessandro Capuccio have worked together for a while now on Moon Knight. How has that writer-artist relationship changed and evolved over time?
It's been great. Alessandro was an artist that I was not familiar with at all when Tom said, like, this is the guy we've got on Moon Knight. And you know, at first I was like, well, I don't know, like, who is this guy? He's got no credits. I'm like, what's, I like, this seems like a bad idea. And then I was almost immediately proven wrong, because Alessandro is, you know, he's so good to work with. He's so accommodating. He's very understanding. But also, you know, he's hungry. He works fast. And improves incredibly quickly. You know, you look at that first one page he did for that, the preview of Moon Knight back when Jason was writing Avengers, to you now, and he's like a different artist. It's incredible. So Alessandro is one of those guys that you can kind of trust to do anything, where if I write something in a script, I know he's going to do it extremely well. And you know, we talk a lot about stuff, about, you know, new characters, talk about designs, talk about kind of, you know, the vibes you're looking for, that kind of thing. So yeah, it's been a great relationship. I'm really happy that he was the artist who came on this book, because I don't think it would be the same book without him, and I don't think the book would exist without him anymore. I think it'd be one of those things that gets to me, like, listen, you know, Moon Knight's not a book that usually goes 30 plus issues, you know. And I think a huge part is this signature look that Alessandro has put on Moon Knight. And, you know, he's with that, I think this is his first ongoing series, and he's already put himself in this kind of pantheon of Moon Knight artists. So yeah, I consider myself very lucky to have the opportunity to work with him.
And that certainly is some good company. You got Sienkiewicz in there. You got Declan Shalvey. Yeah. You got David Finch.
Oh, yeah. No, it's not a light bench by any means, but he certainly earned a spot on it.
So pivoting again, in the most recent arc of Doctor Strange, Stephen, Black Cat, Taskmaster, and Hunter's Moon form a party to deal with what is essentially a living game of D&D called Cobalorum. Was there, given this assemblage of characters, all of whom you've written in your time at Marvel, was there a part of you that wrote this kind of like, it's goodbye is not the right word because it's not goodbye, but it's the word I'm using here. Like it's saying goodbye to the most recent part of your career where you gave many of these individual characters life or new life as you move into this new phase where you're doing, you know, big events and X-Men and stuff like that. Mm-hmm.
I think that's an interesting way to look at it. That's not how I considered it, mainly because this was a story that I have been meaning to do since I got both Moon Knight and Doctor Strange. I mean, I got Moon Knight and Death of Doctor Strange, not at the same time, but fairly close to one another. And I had Black Cat still going at that time. As you know, this kind of thing, I'm like, well, I've got a thief, I've got a magic user, I've got a priest here, and I need a fighter. I'm like, well, obviously that could be Taskmaster, who's another one of my special boys. And so it's a story I've been thinking about for a while, because there's something extremely charming about the for lack of a better term, tropes of old D&D. You know, this the four roles in an adventuring party kind of thing. So it's less a goodbye and more of a, this is, I'm finally getting a chance to do this story, because, you know, it slots kind of right in my schedule, in the schedule of all these books where I want it to. And, you know, it's just a two issue arc, but it's, you know, it's a lot of fun, and I'm getting to do a bit of silly stuff after a lot of like really serious stuff we did, with General Strange and stuff like that. And the serious stuff we will be getting into, because it doesn't go easily for Doctor Strange during Blood Hunt, and we've been setting up some of the pieces for that in Doctor Strange as we've been going along.
Are you yourself a big D&D player? Because as someone who's been playing for 30 years, the way that was structured, two thumbs up, no notes.
ironically enough, no, in that I've never been that into Dungeons and Dragons, but I do really like role-playing games. Over here on my shelf is gradually building my second and third edition Shadowrun collection. And you know, I bought it for my first art role-playing game book when I was in like the sixth grade or something like that. So it's always been near and dear to my heart. It's just strange that Dungeons and Dragons has never been. I played a lot of Shadowrun when I was a kid, Rifts, Deadlands. Now I play mostly Powered by the Apocalypse games, Monster of the Week, Spirit of 77, Fellowship, and Urban Shadows. So yeah, it's stuff like that. That stuff's always near and dear to my heart. And there's a certain fondness for the period of time that I got into it. Like, I've still got my collection of Inquest magazines from the 90s. I've got my box of old Magic cards from the 90s. It's a lot of fun to kind of look back on those. And I think it's very helpful to me too now as a comic writer, and especially now as an X-Men writer, where everyone's crawling out of the woodwork to tell me how bad my book's going to be, to look back at letters sent to Inquest with like, you know, Magic the Gathering has fallen off. Like, this is from like, what, 1997? It's like, it's falling off. Like, the good old days, it was never like this. I'm like, this is like, you're talking about the sixth expansion for this game. You know, 20 some years later, it's still going strong. And then, you know, I myself made a decent amount of money off of writing the comic book, you know? So it's a good reminder that people are always going to be upset and complaining and saying something's terrible, and then 5 years down the line they're going to say this is back when the thing was good, unlike now, because something's changed, you know.
The number of people who complained about D&D third edition and now the same crotchety people. It's like, yeah, it's fifth edition, whatever, the third edition, that's where it's at.
Yeah, that was the golden age. Yeah, the golden age, like Marvel comics, has a sliding time scale.
Does it ever? And I love those Powered by the Apocalypse games. I've run Monster of the Week a couple times myself, and it's a real fun system.
Yeah, it works well for me because the group I run it for, so we finished a campaign. I don't think I'd ever finished a campaign before. So it was very satisfying, and I was running it. But most of the players had never played an RPG before. So something with simple and dynamic rules, and also a contemporary setting, was just so much easier for onboarding new players than something with a more complicated or crunchy rule set in a complex setting, you know, like the Forgotten Realms or something, that people would bounce off. Like, you know, we're all in our 30s and 40s now. I don't really have time for homework.
As a game master, have you ever railroaded a party in the same manner as Mordo in this arc?
Oh yeah, I railroad them all the time, but they're all relatively inexperienced players. They don't actually know what that means. But I mean, also the thing is, I'm a professional writer of bullshit, so. I'm pretty good at cloaking my my machinations, but also there's a certain expectation where I'm like, listen, we are all, like I said, in our 30s and 40s, we all have busy lives. We don't really have time to fuck around here. So you can either do the thing that I prepared and we can all have a good time, or like, you know, whatever. But also, you know, these Powered by the Apocalypse games are largely meant to be low prep and high improv, so. You can just kind of end up rolling with a lot of stuff sometimes.
Yeah, I've got to just throw in my just the one I've been playing with the same group for well over a decade now.
Yeah, okay.
And the one thing I have always known about them is you give them a shiny side quest and they will immediately skid into the shiny side quest. So the main thrust of urban fantasy campaign, ancient fey outcast was attempting to gather powerful artifacts on the mortal realm to reclaim its power.
Sure.
Set up a whole side thing involving a war between a coven of vampires and a local mobster. So that they would go and deal with that, and said Fae's agents could steal the magical sword that they were guarding in a museum.
There you go.
The only time in 12 years they decided to not go on the side quest and instead just sit there and watch the sword. I was like, but I created all these mobsters and these vampires, and I gave you an NPC who can cast fire magic to help fight the vampires, and you're going to just sit and watch the sword? Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I have to come up with a couple of fey agents and a fey hound real quick for you guys to fight in the museum, because I didn't in the world expect you to stat out any of the fey right now.
Yeah, and I mean, and that's an important skill to have in running a game, but it's also an important skill to have as a writer. I'm not as good at long-term planning as someone like Al Ewing is. Like, I heard him lay out his grand scheme for Thor. It's incredible. But I could never think that far ahead. For me, a lot of it is it's improvisational. It's as it's being written, things change on the page in a way that I usually don't. I don't expect or, you know, can't necessarily plan for. And those changes are usually end up being what I want, you know, what I want something to be, and change the direction of things moving forward. So it's a useful skill to have, but so is being good at making comprehensive long-term plans, which I would like to be able to do.
It's the difference between writing a symphony and jazz. They both have their place.
Sure. Yeah, it's good. I think that improvisational skill is frequently exercised in running a role playing game.
You know, they didn't at all realize that the Hound of Ulster and a Fey prince were things I was pulling completely out of my ass at that particular moment. So I pulled it off, but it's like, oh, I had all these vampires that I wanted you guys to fight.
Well, I mean, and that's another thing from writing is sometimes you'll plan something or come up with something and have a use for it, but nothing's ever wasted because you can always use it down the line for something else. I mean, I have an Evernote note, my note-taking app that has notes going back to 2008, I think. So I mean, a lot of it's garbage and a lot of it is stuff I've forgotten what it means, but anytime I need a name or a character or setting or something, I'll just start trawling through. And somewhere in those, 15 years of notes, I'll find something interesting.
So we talked about the supporting cast in Moon Knight, and you've also taken new paths with some of the supporting cast on Doctor Strange. Mm-hmm. Wong is now an agent of Wand, which mm-hmm. feels like we've seen a lot of the butler archetype characters in recent years get slightly more or different life. Wong does this. Jarvis spends as much time as the guardian of Nadia Van Dyne as he does as the Avengers butler. Alfred is dead. Don't even get me started on that right now. Is that something that you thought you specifically chose? Like, I think I want to do this for Wong, or was there Wong is Doctor Strange's manservant really needs to sort of move to the side as a concept?
Yeah, I think that was something that Darren and I both sort of talked about when I started working on Doctor Strange. Darren was pretty adamant. He's like, listen, it's not a good look. The Asian, the faithful Asian servant is such a pulp trope that has, aged like milk. So we wanted something to give Wong agency. And it wasn't till we got into Doctor Strange that we did the Agent of Wand stuff, because he was very present in Death of Doctor Strange. He's extremely present in Strange when Clea was the Sorcerer Supreme. Because he was a character in mourning because Stephen Strange was dead. The issue where we focus on Wong, where he's doing his investigation in Strange, which I think was like 7, maybe it's the one where Lee came back to draw it. It's one I really like because get a bit of Wong's interiority. We see a little, a bit of his history. The discussion of like I was like, well, I'm sure Wong's dad could also be called Wong. And Darren's like, well, his dad's called, Hemir the Hermit. I'm like, well, Wong could be his last name. It's fine. And so we had a lot of back and forth on that. And then because of that, the way Strange shook out, it just kind of made sense to have Wong be Agent of Wand. I thought, it's a fun change for him. It puts him in a different kind of realm. And also, it gets him out of the sanctum because Doctor Strange is pretty much focused on Clea and Steven. And I mean, ultimately too, the world we live in, we don't want our heroes to be the kind of people that have servants, like outside of some situations, I'm sure, but it's not very relatable anymore. I think Doctor Strange is a character as I write him is not perhaps not as relatable directly to people because I kind of write him as a an older oily weirdo like a Vincent Price character, but we still see the way he reacts to things, we see how he feels about things that I hope comes off as human and genuine.
Of all the Marvel characters that you've written to date, was there one that you had a tougher time getting a bead on at first?
Miles Morales for sure. He was in the Spider-Verse series that I wrote half of, I think. I wrote the first one, the third one, and the sixth one, I think. And yeah, I had a tough time with Miles because Miles isn't, there's no shittiness to Miles. Whereas, you know, writing Taskmaster or like Black Cat or these are characters who are very selfish. And a character who is explicitly not selfish and not shitty was a bit of a tough go for me because I'm like, well, I don't really know how to write this character. I'm used to like playing to their foibles, their weaker sides. And of course, you know, as time goes on, I end up dealing with much nobler characters, you know, looking at the Avengers and stuff like that. But that was kind of the first time where I was like, I'm not really sure how to get a handle on this character because they're, you know, they're too heroic. They're too good. They're not in this for a selfish kind of shitty reason.
And as you now have quite a few series under your belt of the characters you've created or concepts you've created, what's the one that you're proudest of to see out in the Marvel Universe?
Good question, because I haven't created that much stuff that's made an impact with the Marvel Universe. You know, getting, I think the best expression of that would probably be in Black Cat with Felicia's bisexuality, it being a throwaway line from the Kevin Smith run, taking that and, you know, and bringing it to the forefront a bit. Because it's something that people latched onto because it was this kind of representation is important to people, but nothing was ever done with it. So taking it and bringing that out and making it something people can, you know, look pe people can look at for some sense of representation or, you know, to see themselves in a story, and then to see that continue and be something that other people are, you know, using and exploring and, you know, celebrating has been, you know, it's been really nice. I think it's been and, you know, thankfully it came off well enough that you know, it didn't do it too badly, and you know, people weren't upset with it. So
At this point, how do you budget your time when it comes to writing? Do you have like a designated, like, oh, okay, it's X-Men Day, it's Avengers Day, it's, you know, Doctor Strange Day or whatever? Is it just, you know, the ideas come as they come?
It's basically just all down to the artists. Whoever needs pages next, I need to get them pages so they can work. Because there's few things more embarrassing than an artist losing time and money because I haven't written the script, which is the much easier side of the equation than drawing the book. So yeah, that's my main concern is to make sure that everyone's working and no one is losing time and money, which are the same thing, waiting for me to do my job.
So the first time I ever got to speak to you was New York Comic Con 2019. I think at
Oh
that
yeah,
point,
that's my first Comic Con.
oh, how about that? Yeah. You had just published a story in Alpha Flight True North. I think that's what we ended up talking
Yes.
about at the time. What is a piece of advice you would give that Jed from 5 years ago?
Stop trying to push Ulysses Bloodstone because it's never going to happen. That was a period of time when I was heavily pushing Ulysses Bloodstone. He was in that Alpha Flight story. He was in Black Cat. He did a Bloodstone story in Bizarre Adventures, and I was like, yeah, I'm just really into this character. I'm going to try and make something happen with him. As a fool's errand.
As classic characters go, he's a good MacGuffin.
He's great. Well, I mean, that's the thing. We did that Bizarre Adventures book. Jake emailed me again. This is like real early on in my career. He's like, yeah, we're doing like a tribute to the old black and white magazines. And like, I loved Savage Tales, the two-part Red Nails story Barry Smith did. And because it's incredible, it's like gorgeous in black and white. I was like, hell yeah, I'm gonna do a Conan story. Jake's like, hell yeah, you're not. I was like, I couldn't remember if it was a rights thing or if Jason was doing something with Conan, but it didn't, like, it just didn't happen for that. I was like, well, shit. He's like, well, there's a whole bunch of other characters. There's was it like Starstalker and Wood God and all shit like that. And I was like, wait, what about like Ulysses Bloodstone? Because I could just do Conan with him because he's been around since like cavemen were around. And he's like, yeah, sure, go ahead. I'm like, great. So like one of the first captions of that Bloodstone story talks about how Bloodstone, the barbarian, the hunter, had come down through the I think the sullen, leaden-skied borderlands, which was originally Cimmeria. He's like, no, you can't call it that. I'm like, all right, fine, I'll just talk about it in adjectives.
So as we start to wind down here, what's your convention kind of signing schedule looking like coming up?
Pretty sparse at the moment. Sunday I'm going to be at Back Issues Comic Con in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, just because it's near where I live. My friends are putting it on. I've got East Coast Comic Expo coming on in Moncton, New Brunswick, again because it's pretty close. I like doing a little jaunt. I'm going to be going to oh wait, if this hasn't been announced yet, I probably shouldn't say anything. So yeah, it's pretty surprising. I got a few things coming up in the summer. I would imagine I'll be at New York because I generally always am, because Marvel seems to put their summits there now, not in New York, but by New York Comic Con. So yeah, we'll see how it shakes out, really. I'm very tall. I don't like to travel. I don't like to fly a whole lot because I find it very uncomfortable. So I generally limit the amount of places I go to.
What is a comic by another creator that you're excited about right now?
Oh, that's a good question. So much of my reading now is just like back issues of Marvel stuff to make sure I'm getting continuity right. The Unsleeping Eye, Brian Lovell wrote that. Brian's a great artist and a tattoo artist. So the Unsleeping Eye is on Kickstarter right now. It's very cool. They're a real nightmare kind of horror book. Refugium by Simon Roy is also on Kickstarter. It's another great book. I've loved Simon's stuff since he was doing Prophet. It's kind of like lived in pseudo Soviet science fiction stuff is great. I really love it. So those are two that I can think of off the top of my head. This is a name I've only read, so I don't know how to pronounce it, but Murewa Ayodele did Okugan Brutalizer of Gods, which was awesome. It was like a mythic, kind of fantastical African fantasy story. So that first I read the first issue. It's incredible. So I'm looking forward to seeing where he goes with that. And yeah, that's good for now. There's other stuff that I'm psyched for, but it's not been announced, so I can't talk about it.
Sure.
But I will say that there is an unreleased or unannounced X title that I've read the first script for that I think is really extraordinary. I think it's going to be a real highlight for the line.
Okay. Unannounced beyond the nine that have already been named?
Yep.
Oh, okay. All right.
This is gonna be a
Well,
big this is gonna be a big launch, man. There's gonna be a lot of new number ones coming.
all right. Well, listen, that's a good tease to wrap on. Jed, this has been a fantastic time. Final question as we release you back into the world. How can people follow you online and keep up with Blood Hunt, X-Men, Doctor Strange, Moon Knight, Avengers, and everything else you got going on?
I have very little in the way of public facing social media these days, in that I don't have a whole lot of fun on Twitter anymore. Twitter sucks, and now that
The
I
people who
write
are still there
X-Men,
aren't having that much fun either.
yeah, exactly. Now that I write X-Men, it's just kind of like a real signal to noise shit show. So it's largely just used by me for announcements. So if you want to talk to me, I don't know, see me at a show. That's kind of it. But yeah, it's twitter.com/JedMckay, JedMackay. That's pretty much it. I've got an Instagram, but I don't use it, and I have a Facebook, but that's only for people I actually know. See what my cousins are up to, and that kind of thing.
All right, Jed, thank you so much for coming on the show.
I don't know. Thanks for having me.
That's it for this week's show. As a reminder, you can find the Comics XF interview podcast at Comics XF, along with our sister podcasts, Battle of the Atom and Bat Chat with Matt and Will, a Batman ranking podcast co-hosted by Matt Lazowitz and Will Nevin. You can listen to the Comics XF interview podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Amazon Music, Audible, and at comicsxf.com, where new episodes move Tuesday mornings. You can support Comics XF at patreon.com/comicsxf, where a dollar donation gets you a shout out at the end of every episode of the Comics XF interview podcast. A $2 donation gets you early access to this podcast and a shout out at the end of every episode. A $3 donation gets you a sticker, early access, and a shout out. A $5 donation gets you access to our monthly bonus podcast, Our Son Pete, a deep dive into the comic appearances of British mutant spy master Pete Wisdom. A $25 donation lets you request a primer, one of our custom reading guides for a series, character, or creator. And a $50 donation lets you advertise on the show. Big thanks to our patrons, Joel Elod, Shelf Dust, Lisa Slack, Will Redman, Tobias Carroll, Mike Sagawa, Will Nevin, Liz Large, Asimov Fangirl, Carla Pacheco, and Robert Secundus. You're all special, and we love you. You can follow Comics XF on Twitter at Comics XF, me at Daniel P. Grote, and Matt Lazowitz at MattLaz1013. You can also follow Comics XF on Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky. And until next week, remember, Marvel Editor-in-Chief C.B. Cebulski once wrote comics under the pen name Akira Yoshida.